Good morning. This is Cliff, your host here at Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. And I am here in Oakland, where it's a little overcast today, but it's not raining, and we do need rain, as I mentioned before. This week on the Earth Ancients Facebook page, I highlighted a couple of quite interesting articles. One was from Steve Strong, and the article is called "The Status Quo Academia of Mainstream Archaeology." And it seems like there's more and more research being done by non-traditional archaeologists and investigators in that country. And they are finding a tremendous amount of very old artifacts. And in the article, he mentions the stonework at Adam's Rock. It's a very, very interesting article and sheds light on the whole academic world of archaeology and what they're willing to reveal, what they don't have an education or understanding to reveal, and what, in some cases, they completely ignore. And it's kind of a interesting point of view. A couple of other areas. I continually post information from a number of auction houses, and I've mentioned this before, literally thousands and thousands and thousands of artifacts are flowing out of Central and South America, and I usually highlight one or two pieces. And the piece that I highlighted, actually there's two pieces that I highlighted for this week. One is this interesting figure with what appears to be a pilot's helmet on, and he's dark brown, and it's very it's a form-fitting helmet. And then along with that is what I termed 2 years ago when I discovered this fella, I called him the Guatemalan pilot because he has full pressurized equipment on. He's wearing a face mask. He's got a helmet. And you take a look at it. I've had a couple of people kind of shake their heads. In fact, I even had an airline pilot say, "That looks just like the face mask that he wore in case there's a zero oxygen situation in the cabin." So, something to consider. Take a look at our Facebook page, because it's always filled with constant information, continual bits and pieces of information on what's happening in the world of archaeology and some of the discoveries. My next guest is a fascinating fellow. His name is Jim O'Conn, and he's a professional engineer. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, and then we'll bring him on here. Jim has pursued a lifelong passion for Mayan archaeology, has combined his unique professional engineering experience with the search for lost Mayan technology. He has applied his diverse engineering talents to explore and investigate nearly inaccessible Mayan sites located deep in the dense jungle. Traveling by dugout canoe, hacking his way through the tangled jungle while fighting off millions of insects and sleeping in tents, he was able to verify feats of Mayan engineering and virtually reconstruct the mystery of lost Mayan technology. He's also the author of Lost Secrets of Mayan Technology, and he actually calls himself a forensic engineer. Jim, are you there with us? Hi, Jim.
Yes, I am.
Hi. What is a forensic engineer? Tell us that, what that's all about.
A forensic engineer is that sector of engineering that follows design and construction. It is an engineer that dissects a failure, a distressed building. It could be a leaky building or a total collapse. And you assess the damage, you analyze the design, and determine the causation of the failure.
Interesting. How did you first get interested in the Maya? Were you like were you vacationing in Yucatan, or were you in Cancun? And or I mean, how did you get interested in the Maya? Because apparently you've been interested in this for over 30 years.
Actually, it was 47 years ago that I went into my first ruins in the Yucatan.
Wow.
When I was in 10th grade here in Atlanta, I had a history teacher who was unique. He taught not about Charlemagne and Napoleon, but talk about lost civilizations and occult religions and, you know, extinct languages. And that got me interested in the same thing we're talking about today, the lost civilizations. And there was not much written on the Maya in those days, but in the mid-60s, I was working as a professional engineer, and I was able to take off a year now and then and go visit the sites, the areas with the sites that I thought were interesting and would, give me something to think about. Let's call it that, to think about. So I took a year and bought a brand-new Volkswagen camper and traveled from New York to California and all the way down through Mexico and into what was called British Honduras. And in the meantime, I stayed, visited, toured all the Mayan sites that were found at that point. There weren't that many.
Wow.
And I was part of finding some of the sites later on. So I became avidly interested in that trip and began to pursue my my studies in the written works and the materials written by explorers and archaeologists.
Right. So driving all the way down to British Honduras, that's Belize, correct?
Right.
Right. So you went from Belize and then you just kept going north as far as you could go, I guess, and saw the ruins all the way up to the Yucatan Peninsula, or did you kind of just make your way around for a while?
Well, I came down from California and down the west coast of Mexico, saw the ruins of Mexico City. That's the first big ruins, the Teotihuacan ruins. And then worked south from there, where I saw all these Maya sites, the Chichen Itzas, and these are the ones we're opening. Uxmal was just being excavated, and all the way down into British Honduras to sites there. So then I came back sort of the same way, back to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. So in your book, The Lost Secrets of Mayan Technology, which is, I really suggest whoever's listening that you really get a copy of this book. It's fantastic. You suggest that the Maya have been wrongly identified as Stone Age people. Tell me why you feel that that's a misnomer. That's an incorrect statement.
Well, you hit it on the head with your preamble when you said archaeologists don't have the training. When archaeologists are trained to identify a civilization, they use a three-age system, Stone Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age. And this all comes from 1791, when the curator of the first museum ever to do this, which was in Sweden, was asked by the king to sort of divide and identify all these ancient hunting weapons they had. All the guy could do was put them in three piles: stone pile, copper pile, and iron pile. And this is it. This is in my book. If you look into all the books on archaeology, this is how they started the whole thing. Well, that was easy. They could identify known civilizations that way, the Sumerians and the Egyptians and the Babylonians, etc. But when it came to the Maya were the last civilization to be discovered. And they were known, but not even the cities were known until 1841, when John Lloyd Stevens and Frederick Catherwood explored the ruins and wrote books on this amazing civilization that was full of giant cities and otherworldly architecture, et cetera. So all the archaeologists could do was use the three ages, and they couldn't find any metal tools. They didn't find any bronze, and they didn't find any metal, so they determined that the Maya were Stone Age. Now, as they started discovering the accomplishments of the civilization, they found all these technologies, and they didn't recognize them at the time, and then they deciphered some of the writing. And then now they can do it all, but they discovered that the Maya were really advanced in sciences like astronomy and mathematics, and one of the three original written languages in the world. I mean, they were so far ahead of Europe, it was unbelievable. But they never changed the categorization because they didn't have one. They didn't have another way to categorize. They did, actually, but they didn't pay attention to it. There was a New Zealand archaeologist came up with a methodology for identifying a civilization which involved sciences and public works and, you know, the kind of things that really make a known entity as a science. And but they haven't adopted this. So they still refer to them as Stone Age. And I do give talks at archaeological conferences, and I was told recently by a really good friend of mine, a famous archaeologist who was the editor of National Geo for 40 years, archaeology editor. He said, nobody does that anymore. I said, yeah, he does. I said, look at your son. His son is a famous epigrapher. His son still refers to Maya, and here he is in his 40s, as Stone Age. So that's where the Stone Age comes from.
It's amazing. In your book, and we're going to get to specific points that you've discovered because they're fascinating and it really does show technology. You say in your book that the Maya appeared with a complete mathematics, engineering, and other sciences all in place without showing any signs of early development. I mean, how can that be? I mean, to my mind, and my hypothesis for the Maya, and I've traveled to Yucatan maybe 12 different times and studied with a couple of different elders, and that's a lot of Mayan traditions is what my focus is. Yours is more of from an engineering standpoint, which is fascinating. But doesn't that give us a clue that their science, their technology came from an earlier civilization? Mathematics, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, the point I'm trying to make, and I want to hear what your opinion is to my mind, it would be, you know, if you have a sophisticated science, it takes, you know, a long time to develop science. So if they don't have an inception point, where is their inception point? What is your feeling on that?
When you and I talked the other day about the origin of the Maya sciences and technology and art and all their really sophisticated methodologies, I did some research, okay? I went back and said, what did the archaeologists say, okay? Well, they take everything back to about 1000 B.C. At that point, there were cities being built with the pyramids, which you're familiar with, and between 1000 B.C. and the time of Christ, they invented the number zero. They had sophisticated mathematics. Writing became, by 700 B.C., became apparent. I'm saying full-scale writing was, you know, found on carvings, et cetera, because that's the only thing that would last that long. Everything else, like paint or paper books, would have disintegrated. But the sciences, the astronomy, everything sort of appeared in its almost full form 1,000 years before Christ. Then after that, they all advanced. They became more and more sophisticated until the demise 2,000 years, we talked about. So somewhere around 1,000 B.C., the notion got into the culture that they had the ability to do all this scientific and technological work. And there was no, but before this, like, let's say it was like pulling a window shade down about 1000 BC, there was nothing before that. So, okay, some of the theories was that the Olmec, that was supposed to be an older religion, an older culture, influenced them. Well, now they found older Maya structures than the Olmecs. So if they're older and they're more advanced than the, say, 100-year-old earlier Olmec, well, they couldn't have influenced them that way. And they think there was a mix and an exchange of ideas at that time, which in the dense jungle of a bunch of people that are really separated by not much distance but a lot of terrain, that doesn't wash very well with me. There had to be some influence from the past, but I can't prove it. Mm-hmm. I don't have any evidence.
Yeah.
It's just apparent. And some archaeologists, and this is the other day, I've been doing this work since we talked, they feel the same way, but they don't have any proof that there was.
Yeah, there's no proof of an earlier
right.
culture because
like it was somebody.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Well, let's talk about some of this amazing technology that you've discovered. And from your point of view in all your travels, in your book, you have a wonderful section on the development of what I'll call Mayan concrete. And why is concrete such a marvel? And tell us what you discovered about how they developed and made concrete.
Well, concrete is currently, in the 21st century, the world's most popular construction material. Everybody uses it, okay? I mean, they're steel, but concrete is the number one construction material in the world. Let's go back to the Romans. They had concrete, but they made with cement, but their cement was not fabricated by the Romans. It was dug out of the ground in a natural cement formed by volcanoes. Mount Vesuvius is one of the large sources. And when this material ran out, they ran out of concrete. They couldn't make any more. In fact, most of their work with concrete was done in Italy, because north of the northern border, they couldn't transport it. It was too heavy a load to carry. So because of Maya, and the Maya discovered how to fabricate cement. The whole Maya Peninsula, the Yucatan, is a limestone shelf. It is limestone 3 feet down under the soil everywhere. So they discovered how to make really hot fires that was similar to, this is 300 BC now, okay? This is before the Romans were using concrete. They discovered how to make really hot fires would raise the temperature of this is a dynamic, thermodynamic kiln, basically, like a Bessemer furnace. They would stack their wood in a certain way and it would vent, and it would cause really high elevated temperatures, like 1,600 degrees Celsius, which is 2,500 Fahrenheit. And it would melt the limestone, which it would stack on top, okay? It melt the limestone and would turn it into cement. That's all it takes. Today, we take limestone and put it in a kiln, and it melts, and it becomes cement.
They figured out a way to build kilns. They must have had huge kilns to melt the limestone and then produce it create the cement.
Well, they were self-destructive. The kilns were made out of wood, and the wood they used was the fuel. So they would light the fire, stack they would build this circular pyre. With a center hole that would be the vent that would cause all the temperature increase. And they'd stack huge amounts of limestone on top and start the fire. And it would burn for 48 hours. And when they were done, they'd set a pile of ashes. So they had to build it. Every time they built, they made limestone into, and wait, every time they converted limestone into cement, they had to build another kiln. So these were self-destructive. They were burned as they made the limestone. So they just made And that was one of the reasons that the Maya had problems at the time of their demise, when they had the environmental and drought issues. They had to take and cut down so many trees to build these kilns, to fire the limestone, to produce the cement, that they had devastated the land. But anyway, that's I'm getting ahead of the story a little bit. That's a thousand years. That's a thousand years in the future when they invented this. So they found that they could mix it with water and some aggregate and pour it in place. And they had, but in the book, it's got tests. Okay, to compare their limestone, the Maya limestone, with modern Portland cement, and it's amazingly similar. The chemistry is like 93% of the Maya cement is similar to the composition of Portland cement. It's amazing.
And what kind of strength does it have? Because they would use it for their pyramids. They used it for their just general construction. Is that correct?
Right. They had structural shapes they used that achieved the optimum compressive strength in these arches and domes they developed for the interior spaces. So what they did, the strength was around 1,500 to 2,000 pounds per square inch. Well, that is what Portland cement was in the early part of the last century when it was being used. So Portland cement now has gotten to be tremendously scientifically modified, and it gives 10,000 PSI. But the Maya only needed, this is going backwards now, in these big temples and pyramids where they had the arches, they only needed 300 PSI, and they had almost 2,000. So they had much more strength than they needed in their cement.
And would you say that the cement, you're saying that it had 300 PSI for all of their, but does that include the big pyramids in Tikal, which are huge?
And they have very little load on them, because when the pyramid extends up, it gets narrower. So when it comes down and that load is collected, you've got a much wider and wider base as you go down, and there's more area to take the load. That's why the loads are so low.
Yeah. Those are engineering marvels. I mean, I've been to enough cities in the Yucatan to be flabbergasted at the engineering feats. Let's talk about the Mayan construction techniques. Some archaeologists do speak of the Mayan arch and its similarity to the Roman arch. In your book, you actually go into a number of details on building floor upon floor with these rooms. What's unique about that in the Maya? To me, it's fascinating because Palenque, where Pakal is laid to rest, the Mayan king, has this tower that has, I believe it's four different levels, and it's all strengthened with cement. So what did you discover with their building technique of building chamber upon chamber?
Well, that tower is a little different than I'm going to describe, because that was used flat beams to build that tower, which is very unique. They put in a layer of a wood, like formwork, and pour concrete on top. And that made the levels, because it was a short span. But in their big temples, seven stories, et cetera, they would build this self-constructing arch, and they would build up walls of stone and mortar, maybe 1 meter high, fill that with cast-in-place concrete, build it up another layer, 3 meters, fill that. Then they would start arching inward, and they would use timber. I'm trying to think of the word. Timber or wood, vertical, horizontal members, they would hold the arch apart as it tried to bend inward as it built the curving part coming in. And they would keep putting in these horizontal thrust beams, I call them, until they closed the top of the arch, you can imagine, with the keystone up top. And then they'd fill everything with castle-based concrete. At that point, when the arch was closed, it would change directions of stresses. The thrust beam would not be in compression anymore. It would be in tension because there would be an outward pressure on the arches to try to collapse. And this beam would hold them in place until another arch was placed adjacent to it. And this was a really unique, it's really a truss. It's not an arch. And the archaeologists call it, I mean, this is one of my real source points. They call it the false arch. They call it the corbelled arch. Well, it's neither corbelled or it's not false, and it's not an arch. I mean, the true arch is the Roman curved arch, as you see. And that took a lot of formwork. They had to make a wooden form to pour the place of stone and put the concrete in it. The Maya didn't have to do that. They had a self-erecting arch, and they spanned 25 feet with it, which is a pretty good span, you know. So
yeah.
That is one of the systems. That's their basic building block. And so what they do, they build a first floor with maybe six of these units side by side. And then they come to the next level, and they build like five. They stagger them like a layer cake. So the walls all line up. The second floor lines up with the first floor, and then the third floor lines up with the second and the first. So all the loads are collinear, and the load path comes down through the walls, which is where it should be, and doesn't get any load on the spanning part. So that's how they built these temples and palaces and all their really fancy structures.
When you look at a ruin, do you look at the way it was laid out, like the I guess it would be a civil engineering kind of a look, or the way it was architecturally designed, or do you look at the buildings individually?
Well, the amazing thing is there's not two buildings that are alike. I mean, they're like going into somebody's house now and then going into a neighbor's house and going into a third house, and they're all different. The living rooms are placed a little differently, and they got the dining room, you know, doing something, and the kitchen's an open floor plan or not. And so what happened in these temples, everybody had their own thing, but they wanted to, there always had to be a door for ventilation facing the prevailing wind. And the next room inside would have two doors sometimes, so it would really enhance, pick up all the ventilation it could. And then on the backside, that would be a similar juxtaposition of openings so that they would get ventilation. And then that would be, if it was big enough, they would turn the corner and do the same thing 90 degrees with different rooms on the end of the building. So, and they all were shaped differently, and they looked differently. And there aren't that many examples of, I mean, like 10 or 12 of multi-story buildings. Extent. Okay, so they're all a little different, but they're all very similar, and they're constructed the same way. All the walls line up.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have any known architectural plans of any buildings that we've found, do we?
Well, only drawings we have are the ones that were developed from the plan that was reconstructed. There's never been anything found except actually at Tikal. There's some graffiti that appears to be a floor plan of the building that it's in. Other than that, no. There's no. That's like the codices, you know.
Yeah.
Those books that were burned by Delanda. Some of them might have been architectural books.
Well, we're going to come up to Delanda in a minute. The reason I ask that question is when I go and see a lot of these ruins, what I see in the reconstruction seems to be guesswork in reconstructing these buildings. And as an example, when I was at Chichen Itza a couple of years ago, the observatory, they had rebuilt a section of the main platform, and it looks like they just kind of guessed at how the building was built, and that kind of bothers me. But I guess if there's no plans, you have to just kind of do guesswork and reconstruct the best you can. What's your feeling on that?
Some archaeologists are really gifted. They can take random stones and place them back again where they belong and make a really nice reconstruction. Consolidation, it's called. But I've seen in 1967, when I was a young man amongst the ruins, I was watching some students, archaeologists, place carvings of Chalk, the rain god, who's got the elephant snout, in the side of the big pyramid there. And the pyramid at that time was covered with timber and all kinds of growies, and it was not at all being... And they were putting in this carving upside down. And you could see it was upside down. And I went up and told them it was upside down.
Oh, God.
So we had a bunch of rookies working on the thing, and they were just messing around. So it depends on the people doing the work. Now, I'm pretty familiar with the observatory at Chichen Itza, and it looks pretty well inside, where they've got the circular arches that form the inside. There's two inside. They look real good, okay? But on top, they've been guessing for years what is on that platform, because the top, the platforms were the work platforms. They did all the observations there. They had their equipment on the platforms, and they had equipment. They had astronomical tools that they used to sight and to measure the different speeds and angles of the heavenly orbs. So that was a real work platform, and it should be very clear that it was just a work for a platform. I don't know about the instance you're talking about, but I haven't been there maybe 3 years. But that is true. It depends on the archaeologist who's doing the work. Some people got it, and some people don't.
Yeah. You know, one of the most amazing things that I've discovered about the Maya is their roads. They call them Zaxbis, right?
Zaxbis.
The Zaxbis, yeah. And the thing that I found when I was at Koba, which is pretty close to Tulum, which is a well-known ruin all right on the water, is that these roads, not only are they engineered to perfection and made to last for centuries, is that they're extremely straight. Like, they use survey equipment or some kind of instrumentation to set them up. They just don't deviate very much at all. What is your feeling on those Mayan roads? I found them just amazing.
Koba, there's 14 major Zaxbis there. Now, I know about this because I wrote papers on the big one that goes from Koba to 160 kilometers away to at Yasruna, straight as an arrow, east-west. And I carried out land surveys, which involved GPS. I didn't walk the whole thing because it's too far to walk. I flew the route with aircraft, and I used remote sensing, a satellite photography, to trace the route. And they are, the very beginning at Koba and the very end has a bearing of 268 degrees, 59 minutes, and 38 seconds. That's 0.9993 accuracy of being a perfect east-west line. Now, we can't do that today. It's just that that line was drawn. And the only way I could figure they did it, they did have the ability to turn a right angle, okay? I know that. So when they took sightings at night, they would shoot the Polestar, which was not Polaris at the time. I can't remember what it is at this moment. But they would shoot on it, turn 90 degrees, and set the stakes for the next day's work. And if you just keep that straight line, you got an east-west line, a perfect one. So that's how they...
So they use heavenly bodies to a planet to align with?
The star, Polaris.
The star, Polaris, I mean, yes.
Yeah, fixed over the North Pole. And remember, they were the best astronomers in the ancient world. their accuracy was uncanny. I mean, their year was only 0.24 seconds off of our measurement of the year, 365 days and 26 whatever the fraction is, and the measurement of the day itself and the period of I'll get all these, say Mars and Jupiter and Mercury, they had those down to like a hundredth of the time that we've got now. I'm not going to get into all the comparative numbers, but they were unbelievably accurate, and they had this stuff early on. This is part of the astronomy that I was talking about that came with that time of really great brainstorming, you know, before Christ mm-hmm. was born, it was where it right. came from. Anyway, they used celestial navigation for their seagoing vessels that use their home base, not the stars themselves. They use the home base and its relationship to the stars. I'm talking about say you're from Chichen Itza and you wanted to go to let's say to Cuba or to one of the islands below there in mm-hmm. the Lesser Antilles. They had a way of guiding their craft by the stars that were based on mm-hmm. their home base. I won't get into it now. It's too complicated.
Yeah.
But it was really amazing.
Now, I didn't know that. I didn't see that in the book, but maybe I just missed that part about...
It's in the chapter on the Canute.
Wow. And what made the roads so sturdy? Did they use cement? Did they cement over the whole thing? Or what did they do to make them so strong and sturdy?
Well, we've heard about the Roman roads, and they were straight, but they used paving stones, and they were at the ground level. In the jungle, the reason the Maya built these roads, you have 6 months of rain and 6 months of dry period. During the dry period, you've got really rough terrain in the jungle. And during the wet period, it's impassable because of the quagmire is created by the mud. So the Maya built their roads 1 meter above the jungle floor, which kept the water off and kept all the mud away. And they built the walls and infilled a 30-foot wide width with concrete and then smoothed it over with a really nice crown of paved concrete. And there's pictures of a book of some of the pavement which has lasted. They're just as smooth as you can imagine. Okay, so and these roads went straight as arrows, like you said. In the aerial survey and on the remote survey of satellite photos of the Kobayashi-no-Sakbe. It is so straight. It just takes a couple of variations here and there that it's unbelievable. But these roads were built strong and durable. In other people's words beside mine, they were the best highways that were ever built until the interstate highway system was built in
amazing.
1956. Yes. That mm-hmm. they were sturdy roads. And they were still in use when the conquistadors came.
And the roads connected each city, or did they come close to each city, and then another road would connect and then go into the city, or how did they? What is the determination on how they worked?
Let's say you had a map of the United States or Google Earth, and you highlighted all the interstate highways. All of those zoom in on cities, right? I mean, almost everyone goes to a city. And the Maya did the same thing. They had routes between Chichen Itza and Merida, and there's this big 360-mile-long Sacbe that goes from Merida all the way down to the coast, which they used to go to Cozumel for worship of the goddess Ixchel. So that road was also an east-west line. It was like 271 degrees, you know, almost the same thing. And it went through right downtown through three major cities, and the terminus was in Merida, and the other one was on the coast. Unbelievable. And there's still roads mm-hmm. that were paved over these sock base that are straight as arrows. Now, that you could pick them up on a Google Earth. I mean, Google Earth is just unbelievable. When I started this work, I had to rent airplanes. I had to fly airplanes.
Oh.
But now, man, Google Earth is so good. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. I have a couple of associates that are satellite experts and do satellite surveys. And one of them, a friend, has pointed out that a couple of the sock bays go, these roads go right into the ocean. And what's unique about it is the road actually continues from the land's edge, and you can see it under the water because it's only, you know, a few feet under, and then the road goes until you can't see it anymore because it's too deep. So there must be cities underwater on the that were covered in water at some point. Well, how do you explain that? I mean, or is there some something underwater we don't know about?
Well, I'm not familiar with that sock bay. The ones that I have seen going to the coast, maybe I didn't have the clarity or the fidelity of his mosaic, but they seem to stop near the shore, and they've been washed away pretty much near the shore because of the wave action. But the level of water has risen in the Caribbean. So if a road went out to a pier, maybe 100 yards out, 200 yards out, in the period of 2,000 years ago, it would be covered now. And that pier would be where people got off the road and into one of these big 80-foot-long boats and go across to to worship at the island of Cozumel. That's the reason it would go to the coast. But I don't know about underwater cities. Now, are they referring to the Caribbean as the...
The Caribbean
okay,
Ocean.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know of any, you know, sunken cities there.
Yeah.
But the roads definitely went down to the shore.
Okay. Let's get on to the boats. Now, this is something I didn't know about. The Maya, your estimation is that they were seafaring people too. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So tell me what you've discovered about that.
Well, they had the capability. They had huge trees, and we're talking about mahogany and avocado, et cetera. They could make an 8-foot-wide craft, 80 feet long. Our best witness is the great navigator, Christopher Columbus, who boarded a Maya trading craft. The boat was 80 feet long, which is longer than his caravel. His caravel was only 76 feet long. So the boat he boarded was bigger than his, and there was no opposition, and it was full of trade goods. It had 30 rowers. It had some passengers. Now, we're talking about a big boat here, 80 feet long and 8 feet wide freeboard, okay? And I've got a drawing of one in the book. You saw that, right? And that thing can carry 23 tons of materials, which they couldn't even get. They couldn't even fill that boat up with enough heavy stuff. So the boats were, we don't know about the sail, okay? I think they had sails. But I have two photographs, which I didn't get in the book, of the ruins of these ancient craft. Some survived. And I've had accounts of people that have found them, and they described them, and they were 8 feet wide and 80 feet long, and they used a tiller like the Egyptian ships did, okay? One of these tillers that went out behind, and it would use up to 30 rowers that would, they could be two across, and they could make the 3,000-mile trip from the Yucatan to the Lesser Antilles. Out of sight of land, and they would use canoe power, I mean manpower, and I think they would use a sail. Now, there was an experiment by some French sailors who used a replica Maya. I hate to call them canoes; they're 60-foot long boat and a cargo vessel, I call it. And they mounted a sail on it, and it worked just fine. So I think the Maya might have used a sail too. But they were seagoing people, had an unbelievable trade network, and that's how all their technology and these trade goods like jade and all these foods that we may talk about that got disseminated around Mesoamerica, that's up north towards Mexico, and all the islands and down south and Costa Rica and Honduras and all the way down to Colombia. They had a really wide trade network.
And we talked a little bit about some of these Egyptian mummies having residues from vegetation from the Central and South America. And what is your feeling on them getting all the way to Europe and the Middle East?
Here we go with our archaeologists again. And this time it extends to geographers. They have held that there was no way that anybody could sail the ocean blue until Christopher Columbus did it, because they couldn't do it. I'm going, well, what about all these giant Egyptian and Roman and Greek and Phoenician ships? Tell me over the 1,000, 2,000-year period that somebody didn't make it and make it back. Well, let me tell you, they did, because evidence is there. And I told you about the book called Transatlantic Trade Before Columbus. And it's got this. The testing for drugs on the mummies didn't come out in this book. It was in everything. It was in Smithsonian and National Geo. They tested Egyptian mummies and found cocaine, and they found tobacco in their skin and remnants of the body that was in the mummy. And the only place the cocaine came from was South America, and the only place the tobacco came from was the Yucatan. So there had to be some back and forth trading. And if the mummies had it, they were really elite in the Egyptians. So you had to have the money to be able to afford tobacco and cocaine. So, but other plants showed up. We got the corn and the pineapple and sunflower, all growing in India and China and stuff like that, thousands of years before Christopher Columbus visited the Yucatan. And these people think that they thought they were native to those countries until they tested the DNA and discovered it was born in the Yucatan.
So your feeling is that there was a trade system thousands of years before modern technology allowed us to boat or fly to these areas, different parts of the world.
Not modern. I'm talking about medieval 76-foot-long boats that were like the boats that you see in the lakes now, okay? That was not even high-tech. It was just a sorry old boat that was captured by well, they gave three boats to Christopher Columbus as a he got raw into the deal when he got that contract to discover the New World. So they didn't give him any very good boats, and they wrecked, the Santa Maria wrecked while he was on the island, so he went back with two boats. Yeah. So it wasn't high tech. It was low tech. They had as good or better boats 1,000, 2,000 years before. So they obviously made the voyage.
Yeah. You know, you keep going back and highlighting the Maya as real engineers. I mean, I didn't know the roads were as straight as they were until I read from your book. But how does a civilization become mathematicians, engineers, and great scientists without research? I mean, they must have had a huge R&D industry somewhere.
They did.
What did you say?
Each city had its own university, and they were incubators of knowledge, and they exchanged ideas. The Maya were there for, it was the longest lived civilization in the world. It lasted from 2000 BC to almost 1000 AD. 3,000 years. Look at us, what we've done in 250 years, not even that much, okay? We've gone to the moon. And look what we do. Let's go another 2,700 years in the future. It's scary what we will be able to do, okay? We won't even be able to dream of what we could be capable of if we don't blow ourselves up in the meantime.
So you said something interesting, though, Jim. You said that at every city, and this is funny, interesting, because Mayan elder Humboldt's men said to me that Chichen Itza was an international university. The city of Chichen Itza in northern Yucatan was a university. And when I asked him about that, he said, yeah, people actually came from other parts of the world to learn there. Now, I know you don't know anything about that, but when you say that each major city was its own incubator of technology, engineering, and science, that's fascinating. And it's even more...
Mm-hmm. And exchange ideas. That was one of the big things that made the Maya strong and made them, remember, they weren't an empire. They were 50 independent city-states, like the Italians had, okay? And they would be independently, and sometimes they'd join in just with some other cities, but basically they were independent. And they had their own think tank, they had their own army, they had their, everything was the same. And when you go from one end of the Maya zone to the other and you look at the hieroglyphics, they all read the same, and they all have the same root language, Yucatec, which is a dialect, okay? So they exchanged ideas, and they spoke in a lingua franca, which was Yucatec, or there's another one that they used also. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge amount of information exchange, and I could see where Chichen Itza would be a learned center, because some cities are known for being religious centers and others for learned capabilities, but they really all were, had their own observatories and their own astronomers, their own mathematicians, and they all worked on problems. And in the engineering. Yep. So Tsakbase is the same wherever you go. The structures are the same. Yeah. The difference is the outside treatment of the buildings, they would be regional styles. In the style of the carving of figures and stuff like that, but the inside would all be the same, all the same structure, the same concrete formula was used everywhere. It was so similar because they exchanged ideas.
So it was actually very sophisticated in many ways. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's go to Guatemala and the discovery of this bridge. How did you tell us about the bridge? Because that is a fantastic discovery. So, how did you find it? When and what got you into to coming up with the concept that it was a pretty good size bridge?
Okay, this is before things changed in the Yucatan. This is before they had the roads. I mean, I'm talking about a time in the 80s, which is just yesterday. But there was no roads to remote sites. There was only dugout canoes to get there, okay? But I'll give you a benefit. We did have an outboard motor on it. That was one of the benefits. But we were visiting sites along the Usumacinta River, which is a really big river that divides Mexico and Guatemala in the south eastern zone. So we were approaching the city of Yaxchilan, which is a very famous and this is one of the religious cities. And as I got close, I saw this structure in the water. It was maybe 12 feet, 3-4 meters high, and it was 35 feet in diameter. It was made out of work stone, and I could see concrete. And I looked on the other side, and there was a smaller, a more ruined ruin there, a more devastated ruin. And I made the comment to an archaeologist, hey, they had a bridge here. And the guy said, no, they could They couldn't build a bridge. They didn't have the technology. Well, I knew they had the technology, and I was going to prove that they had a bridge there if they did have one there. So we landed, and I went, walked down the shore and took photographs, et cetera. And when I got back to Atlanta, now this is a time when the Civil War was going on in Guatemala, and Mr. Brains here got captured by Guatemalan guerrillas. Or I wouldn't be telling the story if I escaped. Anyway, that's another story. Anyway, so I got back to Atlanta, and I started researching these ruins in the river. Well, they were really noticed for the first time when the site was first visited in 1882 by Alfred Maudsley, and he took photographs of them. Since then, archaeologists called it a ruined structure, a temple to the turtle god, an outpost, a toll station. I mean, unbelievable things that just couldn't be because none of the other structures in the city were washed out by the river because the city sat some 45 or 50 feet high on these tall banks above the river. And this river was a really old river. It had a channel that's 300 feet deep in solid bedrock, just worn there over the ages. So in 91, I hadn't come back yet, but I got some friends of mine who were flying throughout the Maya zone during the winter to take photographs over the ruins in the river, and I located the second pier. So I had two piers, and I digitized the drawing and did all the engineering things, you know, with the magic, with the angles and everything, and located, you know, the possibility location of another structure on the plaza of the city that would be the takeoff point, the esplanade. So I went back. And in 1993 and 1994 and 93, I discovered there was the structure. It was called Structure 5. It was unknown usage. It was just a low platform with some five hieroglyphic rises on it that just fell off into the river. Well, at one time, it was a connecting walkway between the esplanade and the edge of the river. And I then did my engineering magic and had to figure out, okay, this is where the forensic engineering came in. What kind of structure could they do that would span 205 feet? I mean, the trees weren't that high. They couldn't do arches. They couldn't do trusses. But they could do suspension bridges because the Maya had invented the strongest rope in the world. And the world used Maya rope all through the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th century until it was used all through the Second World War until 1946 when nylon came in. So I knew they had the rope. I knew they had the reinforced concrete for the towers. So I put together, I'll make it short now, okay? I put together a virtual drawing and then we converted that to computer methodologies using software, 3D software, and we developed a three-dimensional bridge structure and a fly-through. Mm-hmm. And I, let me just, okay, why a bridge? This city is located on a big meander in the river. The river takes this huge meander, which is like a meter at the top, and only 50 to 100 meters wide at the bottom. I mean, it's it's a neck, and at the bottom, at the top where the neck is narrow, they have high hills, and a few men could defend the whole city. And the river is a moat. It's a natural defensive location for the city. It was a wonderful place to build a city, but 6 months a year you couldn't cross that river because of the flood. So in order to have a full-time lifeline, all the hinterlands, all the pollutity of the city, all their agricultural land was across the river. They needed to connect the head with the body. And so they needed a bridge. That was the reason that they built the bridge. And they built it out of the materials which were available to them, which was concrete and stone, and suspension ropes made from their sisal henequen rope. So that's and National Geographic picked it up, and I became famous.
That's it's an amazing bridge. Now, do you estimate that the walking? I think you call it the display or the espolon or the part that they walked on. Was that cement or rock, or was it? What was the part they walked on?
Well, it had to be light, because we're using ropes to hold up something. So they made it out of planks, light planks, and the esplanade, the cables. The bridge was identical to San Francisco Bridge, which you could see, the Golden Gate. It was three spans with two towers in the river, identical. Maybe they copied. Maybe Strauss copied this design in 1937 when it opened. So that, and they had to replace the ropes every year because of the wet climate and because of the fact that it was vegetable fiber in the ropes. They had to replace the ropes every year. And how do I know that? Because down in South America, they've got these Inca bridges, and they have to replace theirs every year because of deterioration. Mm-hmm. So I figured they had to replace them every year. So they could reuse the deck, but they had to replace the rope cables every year.
Well, one thing that's fascinating, and you have it in your book here, is you show an image of a bridge suspension rope mechanism, you call it. And it just looks pretty good size. Is that stone carved and then buried in the soil somewhere, or is it actually part of the bedrock off the shore?
I found three of those. It is buried in the sand along the bank, and it's got, you can see the wear marks on it from the rope, and it's got a very large, heavy body which would anchor it into the top towers. The towers had an arch in them, and there would be one of these rope keepers on each side that would have a large body that would be embedded back into the stonework and the concrete of the tower. So there would be one on each side, and ropes would come over and go on to the end where there would be maintained and stayed at the bottom.
Mm. Well, based on your research and the reconstruction, the forensic reconstruction of that bridge, what was your estimation for its weight-bearing capacity?
Well, that's a good question. The History Channel did a production of the discovery of the bridge, and they had a famous engineering firm, who were friends of mine, by the way, named Arlop. And they did an analysis of the, I called for 6 1-inch cables, and they said it didn't need 6, it only needed 4. So I over-designed the bridge. I did it on purpose. I knew that people would be checking it, and I wanted them to know that I was aware of the fact that the cables were really strong, and the bridge did not need 6 cables. It only needed 4 on each side, and it had plenty of capacity for carrying load. And my scenario for the most load the bridge could sustain would be 5 people abreast walking in a procession across the bridge, loading it up fully. That's the maximum. There weren't any beasts of burden, so we couldn't get those on there. So that was my test of strength.
And your conclusion, and it's also on the History Channel, was that was the longest span in the ancient world. What was the next closest was a Roman bridge, wasn't it? Or what was the comparison?
Well, we're talking about one span. We're not talking about the length of the bridge. Because I'm looking for a chart here. Okay, the next longest span was built in 1377 over the Arno River in Italy. So that was basically 700 years later. And we don't know exactly when this bridge in Yucatan was built, somewhere around 600 to 700 AD. And the hieroglyphics on the stairway have been reworked and re-carved so many times that they're indecipherable. But
I was going to ask you if there's any kind of language regarding the bridge.
Yeah,
okay,
that's
so yeah.
That I didn't be able to get that. But before that was some shorter bridges. It was a 95-foot a bridge that was built maybe about 500 AD. I can't remember all the details on it, but anyway.
We don't really know. As you say, we're not really sure when that Mayan bridge was built. It could have, the Mayans were great rebuilders and modifiers of previous construction, so it may have been there for over 1,000 years or a couple thousand years.
But
we don't know.
It definitely was the longest bridge in the world for 700 years at least. Because that was
wow.
That was 206 feet is a long span. And I measured it myself with kite cord and a Pepsi bottle. Hey, you're not supposed to mess with these things archaeologically. So I had a guy, we put one end of the string in the middle of the pier, one pier, and motored across against the stone current, unrolling this kite cord, which I had marked off 5 foot length. And got to the center of the other one, and there we had 205. That's close enough for me. It may be 206. Who knows? But
wow.
It's so far ahead of the next one that we don't have to worry about it.
And the reason for its extreme state of decomposition, is it because of the raging water just basically pushed it down? Or do you think the
absolutely.
Spanish destroyed it and tore it down?
Well, no, the Spanish did not have anything to do with any of the Maya sites, because they were only interested in something like gold and silver, which would profit them, or slaves. No, the river did the job itself. The river is a raging torrent. The reason the bridge is so high is 75 feet above water level at low water. The flood stage is 45 feet higher than normal, which takes it up to somewhere like 20 feet below the bridge level. But the trees that are disgorged and uprooted upriver come down. These trees are like 8 foot diameter. They still do it. And they have their the branches sticking up 20 feet. So the bridge was built higher than the highest water level, and a floating tree coming down. That's why they elevated the Esplanade 5 steps to get the bridge level higher than the highest bit of flotsam that would be coming down there.
Okay. And so it decayed because of non-use or what?
Oh, yeah.
What was it?
1,000 years passed, 1,300 years.
Yeah.
And it was the action of the river, these huge trees hitting the side of it. It was really strong. It was, a skin of masonry and solid concrete, and it just took years and years, and for 6 months a year, for 1,300 years, we were just getting the hell beat out of it. So that's what did it.
So that's fascinating, and congratulations on that. I'm going to have to look into YouTube and find those the special TV programs on those. I want to move into a little area that I found recently, and we also post on the Facebook page, which was their process for clean water. And in your book, you call it the microfiltration process for clean water. And I'm going to read a short paragraph here, and I want you to tell me how you discovered this, because it's an amazing discovery. Here's the book. The majority of Mayan cities did not enjoy the opportunity of using natural biological treatment processes in their open reservoir systems to provide a dependable source of clean water. The majority of large Mayan cities in the northern and southern highlands depended on colchines of water storage during the dry season. Water stored in the underground structured reservoirs was subject to turbidity and the growth of pathogens. When water was distributed from colchines, it was clouded with sediment and pathogens. Calchun. Okay. So tell me, because when I first went to Chichen Itza in 1995, I saw these missile-shaped cones, and I thought, I don't know what the heck they were. I was like, they're piled. They're piled high, and they're all over the place. So how did you figure out that they had developed these water purification systems? That's amazing.
I started with a basic. They made other systems, which they made a pot out of like a curved ended pot, but a hollow inside that was made out of limestone. Now, the limestone, the karstic limestone in the Yucatan, is a natural filter. It'll strain out anything. Use that word strain, okay? Anything below 6 microns, which is as good as a modern water filter. So if you put water in one of these, not the one we're talking about, Chichen Itza, but one of these open vessels, it will leak through, and it will be clean as the water we drink. It cleans the water you get out of the bottle water now, okay? So I was already aware of those. And we're writing about those, and I was talking to a friend about these cones at Chichen Itza. I was laughing because I first saw them in 1967, and I called them pre-Columbian practice bombs. So they were scattered all over the place, and I couldn't figure out what they were. And then now the archaeologists collected them together and put them in a little fence right by a structure called the Temple of Venus. Platform of Venus.
Right.
Well, that used to be known as the platform of the cones, because that's what Le Pajon, we talked about the guy and his wife who discovered these cones, in the bottom of the structure, which is flat and square like a water purification plant. And they pulled them out and laid them on the ground. And for 100 years, they bounced around the site until somebody collected them all and put them back next to the site, and it's like, what are these? They're asking, what are these things? So, you know, it's been two years, like, what's today? The 22nd, the book came out 2 years ago. I have not been questioned by an archaeologist or calling my hypothesis on those cones, because I think everybody thinks I'm correct in assuming that these filters were used in a pre-Columbian water plant. They took the water out of the Shaltun, yeah. You've seen the water down there, the big Shaltun. It's
yeah.
Green. Yeah, and then
pathogens everywhere, yeah.
Right, exactly right. And they would fill up this pool, and these cones would be below it, and they would slowly soak in the water and filter it through and would go into a lower level where there'd be pots collecting it, you know, at the other end of the system. I'm waving my hands in the air so you can see.
Yeah.
But anyway, I believe that was a water filter system. And
in your book, you actually show a picture of an internal reservoir, and then you have the cones above it. How did the reservoir? How did you find one of these in place?
No, but they're in the drawings developed by Le Pajon. They're in that same position, all pointing downward with the rounded point downward. Anyway, with a pool above them, so they're they're in place.
Well, did La Plajong find his drawings were based on his discoveries, or did he do what he thought was a reconstruction of how the water system worked?
No, he had no idea what the cones were used for, or mm-hmm. that they were part of a water purification system. They basically were an odd shaped. They are. There's the only ones like that that known. Okay, and he pulled them out and laid them on the ground next to the structure.
He was an interesting guy. Now, for our audience who doesn't know who La Pulijong was, he was one of the early archaeologists who photographed with his wife Alice Chichen Itza, Uxmal, and most of, wasn't it northern Yucatan he photographed?
Yes,
Jim?
And he made paper molds. He had advanced techniques of making paper molds of the sculpture.
Yeah, and they actually, and then they would fill those molds and they made reproductions of these temples for exhibitions in the States, in the United States. So he was a fascinating guy. Now, one of the reasons he isn't well known is that his theories are pretty radical. He believes the Maya were descendants thousands of years ago, 9,500 B.C., and most of the archaeologists who followed him, like Thompson and some of the other people, poo-pooed his theories, and he basically was thought of as a quack. But he was pretty far ahead of himself because he could actually read and speak Maya, which was interesting. But getting back to this this water filtration, that's fantastic. And I wanted to go a little into the future here and talk about your upcoming book, Jim. And do you have a title for this book? What's the new book called?
We just changed it. It's called Corn, Cotton, and Chocolate, How Maya Agronomists Shaped Our Modern World.
Okay, so tell us what an agronomist is. And before you tell us that, this is something that I find is dynamite. That more, and that when this comes out, I think that if not the History Channel, someone's going to have to get into this because what you discovered and what may already be known is fascinating. So tell us what an agronomist is and what you discovered in identifying these, I think you call them, it's 19 or 20 world-changing vegetables and vines.
Actually, it's 30, but I recounted after you. Okay, let me tell you what it is. An agronomist is a person, basically a scientist now, who intensely and intellectually changes the properties of a plant and changes the way it produces, the way it grows, et cetera. So they, for instance, the Maya took a native grass and turned it into corn. That is considered the most amazing feat of agronomy ever in history. And that counts all the stuff we're doing with the genetically altered corn and everything now. Scientists say that was the biggest feat of agronomy in history. So the Maya were really great agronomists, and they developed, they had the science we were talking about, okay, with the math and the astronomy and the writing and everything else. But they also had a growing communities. They had 50 city-states to depend on each other. So they developed really great agricultural systems and took wild plants and turned them into unbelievable plants that have spread around the world, and we consider now to be some of our best producing materials.
Well, they're also foodstuffs.
I'm trying
too.
To get,
they're foodstuffs.
Pardon me? Well,
yeah.
Good. I was looking for my list. I've got it now. Anyway, the fiber, like cotton, and food, like corn, include things like avocados and beans and chili peppers, chocolate, cotton, henequen. That's the stuff to make rope out of. Okay, we talked about that a minute ago. Corn, papaya, peanut, pineapple, squash, sweet potato, tobacco, tomatoes, the turkey. Whatever it is, that's the most yielding, meat-yielding bird in the world, vanilla and the sunflower. I mean, these are just 18 of the 33 that have spread around the world and have become really popular agricultural products. At this time, the Maya cultivars are feeding 60% of the world. I mean, the number one grain crop is corn. It beats wheat and beats rice. And the number two, well, the first right behind him is cassava. You go, what is cassava? It's like tapioca comes from. It's yucca. A half billion people every day are fed off of cassava. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Online,
you know, it's yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
What's fascinating is that you say that cotton was developed in the Yucatan or by the Maya. It is like, well, cotton, how do you make that claim? How do you claim that cotton was developed by the Maya?
Well, it was, okay, there's four or five kinds of cotton that grew up around the world. Gossypium hirsutum is indigenous to the Yucatan, and it is the most popular cotton grown in the world today. And it won its way over other kinds of cotton, and the person discovered the cotton. I mean, we owe a lot of this discovery to Christopher Columbus. Christopher Columbus came from a family of tailors. And he knew his cloth. So he absolutely, when he boarded his canoe we talked about before,
mm-hmm.
So here it is right here. It's his fourth voyage. He boarded a Maya trading vessel, and he discovered that there was something more valuable than gold on that vessel. It was a bolt of cotton. He couldn't believe the quality of the cotton. It was unbelievable. So he took the vessel and took off all the trade goods and took the cotton back to Spain, where it was an amazing thing. So then people started buying Maya cotton. And if it was being woven by the Maya at the time, this is not the ancient Maya, but the 14th century Maya, 15th century Maya. And it became the world standard, particularly after the 18th century, when the Industrial Revolution started in England with their textile mills, and they started using American-grown cotton, which was all this Maya cotton, the Gossypium hirsutum. And hey, anybody doubts it, just Google it, and you'll see that it's a real thing.
So
I mean,
I
can talk about it more.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, I just find it just amazing that so little attention is paid to these brilliant people. And what's even more interesting is the way that they developed these food crops, the cement, this technology doesn't heed well for an image of a heathen wearing a loincloth. To my mind,
never
I think that's
loin
wrong. It just seems to me that there's a missing element in their history where they either inherited it, or it was handed down to them, or it was a tradition. It was a cultural tradition to educate their people, and it all derived from an early civilization that we don't know about, who were technologists. And it's just fascinating because when we're talking about crop propagate development, that's chemistry. That's getting in there and testing strains and combining growth of
right
of yeah. I mean,
collecting
that's not
the,
like
the,
something you
the best example and propagating those. You're right. It was the scientific method.
Yeah, I mean, they had a scientific method for that, and it's just. There just seems to be something missing. There seems to be something missing in our understanding of the Maya. And
I'll tell you, it's the archaeologists. They don't study there are art history majors and anthropologists who declare themselves archaeologists. They're not technicians. Mm-hmm. They're not doctors. They're not biologists. And they're not historians in the real sense. I hit on this idea because I was already in the past with them, and I started seeing all these similar Maya products that we're using in the old days that we're using now. And I started doing some research, and nope, there's nothing written on this. And it slipped through the cracks. It slipped through the cracks.
Yeah. And I think you've done.
Let me read one thing, okay? This is from the new book, and I'm talking about how the Maya outlasted the collapse of the Royal Egyptian kingdoms. They outlasted the classic Greek. They marshaled mm-hmm. on the rise and fall of Rome and terminated during the reign of Charlemagne. However, none of these historic nations or personalities had any knowledge of the existence of the remote Maya civilization. They were the phantoms of history, and they still are.
Wow. And the title of the book, again, give us the name of the title.
The work title is Cotton, Corn, and Chocolate, How Maya Agronomists Shaped Our Modern World. I know it's
fantastic.
We'll change it around. It'll get neat before it's over. But going to the publisher's looking at it now.
That sounds like a fascinating book, Jim. Thank you very much for being with us. Where can we get the book? The current book it's available still on Amazon. The Lost Secrets of Mayan Technology, right?
And I will do a little bragging. I looked at it yesterday, and it was ranked 19th on the Maya history bestsellers. I can't believe it. After 3 years, it's still ranked.
Fantastic. Where can we hear from you in the future? Are you going to be on TV shortly? Are you going to be at speaking anywhere for the audience to listen? Where can we hear
from you? I don't have
anything
planned, but watch for a sign in the sky.
Jim, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. And I'm going to keep posting your material as it comes up.
Okay.
So that's it for this week. Thanks very much.